Honestly,
we are officially back. It's been a few months, but we've been adapting to being a family of four. And we're back with a whole new kind of look, feel and vibe. We're celebrating our beginning with a returning guest, Susie Redding, one of the UK's leading psychologists and self-care experts. We explore why taking care of yourself feels selfish in a culture that celebrates selflessness. We unpack guilt, unworthiness, apologizing culture, childhood conditioning, and the quiet self-punishment hiding inside of wellness. If you struggle to rest, say no, or ask for help, then this will be your roadmap back to self. Before we get started, a little question for yoga teachers out there. When was the last time you actually felt inspired, rested, and clear about where you're heading? Like many of us hit a wall, you know, the spark fades, the body aches, the vision blurs, and the why kind of gets buried beneath the admin, the travel, and endless giving. Now, I think you don't need to quit teaching yoga. You just need a bit of a reset, space to breathe, be held, and remember actually what lights you up. And that's why I've created a Yoga Teachers UK retreat. It's a weekend designed to reignite purpose, help you refine your craft, and refill your cup. It's tucked away in 75 acres of woodland, lakes, and meadows at a place called the Vedanta, not massively far from London. And through the weekend, there'll be growth, masterclasses, and little chats about why we do what we do. There'll be restoration in the form of sound healing, jacuzzis, saunas, and there'll be nourishment with amazing, amazing vegetarian food. So if you're interested in that, 27th of February to the 1st of March 2026 is when it's happening. So it's at the Vedanta in Lincolnshire. You'll also get a 10-hour CPD certificate if you fancy that. And code ADAM10EB will get you 10% off until the 15th of December. And if you need a yoga mat to go with that, remember, Lifeforms are the best yoga mat in the world. I'm sure they've got a sale on right now. And code HUSTLER10 will always give you more off the price, whether that be a sale price or normal price. Check them out.
Honestly unbalanced.
Before we dive in, let's kind of just check in with how you are and like what's your internal weather today. How are you feeling today before we get going?
Do you know what? I'm feeling excited. I'm feeling really excited, Adam. Thank you. And how are you?
Well, I'm good. Wait, okay, this is our first podcast back in a while, so I'm excited. But you've got a reason to be particularly excited, that your book's out this weekend, all about selfishness.
It is. It's 2 years in the making. She's finally waiting in the wings, ready to be revealed. And for the first time, Adam, I had the opportunity to voice the audiobook as well, there are lots of love notes in this book, so I loved having the opportunity. She's not going to be just in your hands. I'm going to be in your ears as well. So a really beautiful opportunity.
So what made you think that this was the right time to release a book like this? The selfishness in the title.
Can we start with the title first?
Yes, of course. Go for it.
Yeah, because I'm aware that this how to be selfish, you know, I think we recoil when we hear the word selfish. No one wants to be a selfish asshole. Okay, and this book is not about encouraging anyone to be stingy, miserly, uncaring, greedy, inconsiderate. That's not what it's about. It's about self-advocacy. I didn't call it that because, you know, self-advocacy is not going to turn anyone's head. Selfish makes us all, you know, go, what on earth is she saying, right? I needed to write this book because I am seeing a pandemic of not enoughness in my consulting room, on the mat when I teach. I'm seeing it in steeped through the comments on my social media posts. There is this huge feeling of we're not worthy of nourishment and care. So I wanted to write a book that would help us understand why we feel so phobic of being seen as selfish and how that is a huge barrier to not only us taking care of ourselves, but also us receiving the love and support that we all need, because people need people.
Was selfish ever a dirty word for you? And if so, when did it change? What changed it?
Oh, it changed in the process of writing this book. Okay. Because I see this as how to be selfish. I want people to reclaim the right to self. And I've always loved the word self. Now, obviously, I've been talking about self-care for the last decade, But even there, I think we've become so phobic of being seen as selfish that people don't even want to do self-care because it feels too closely tied to selfishness. And I've seen people say, let's rebrand it. Let's not call it self-care. Let's call it energy management. And I'm like, no, I want to reclaim the right to self. I want people to understand that it's okay to honor our humanity. And what's our humanity? It's the right to have feelings and needs.
Because that's so different to what I thought when I read the title of the book. Just the title. Because it threw me back to a philosopher I read when I was 18, a work called Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. And so what she championed was almost a rational self-interest. Like you have a moral duty to prioritize yourself kind of over everyone else. It's all about you to some degree. And her argument in her fiction piece was, you know, it was all about this tycoon that was getting richer and richer and richer. And the idea was that if you take away his right of being as rich as he possibly wants, he'll stop working and all the great minds will stop working. You know, I liked that book when I was 18. I really don't like it now and her ideas. But that was my thought when I had this idea of what to be selfish was. So what's your take on how a modern person who is very like me, a bit conscious of that word, particularly perhaps in the wellness industry, where you are supposed to give of yourself to serve, how would you persuade them that to be selfish is not perhaps what they think it is?
Okay. So to preface this whole conversation, this book is written for people who couldn't be selfish if they tried. Okay. So we're talking people who find it very difficult to accept offers of help, to voice their opinion, to rest, to relax. Yeah, people who apologize literally for being on the pavement. That's who this book is written for.
English people, basically. Sorry.
So I'm so sorry. You know, someone bumps into you in the supermarket with their trolley and we say, oh, sorry. You know, we literally apologize for our existence. You know,
I was in Nepal. Sorry to interject. It's a funny little anecdote. I was in Nepal for a while when I was younger and the host family, he counted how many times I said sorry or thank you while I was there. And it was obscene. Like the number I said it in 24 hours was absolutely crazy. And it's, it is such an English thing, isn't it?
It is, because we have been conditioned to revere selflessness.
Mm.
But really, I think what I'm seeing, this, like I mentioned, this pandemic of not enoughness, this chronic feeling of being unworthy, I would suggest that selflessness is not the virtue that we think it is. I would suggest that it's a coping mechanism. And so this book is designed to empower people with the skills to be able to speak up on their behalf. First, it's about coming home to self so that we can actually reconnect, because I think we've been systematically distracted and disconnected from self. But then we've also been silenced by a whole heap of more modern cultural threads of resilience, being self-sufficient, being grateful, you know, all of this overweening emphasis on you must grow through your adversity. It all silences us and it makes us feel guilty for struggling. Mm. So the nub of this book, this is very different to what you read at 18 about prioritizing self over everyone else. That's not what this is about. And anyone who knows me, anyone who's followed me on Instagram, anyone who's read my previous 9 books will know that the thought of being uncaring to others is abhorrent to me. I have a giant heart. For the last 10 years, I've been encouraging people to feel more comfortable with nourishing self. But I still think there is this fundamental block. People are saying, yeah, you could give me all the practices that don't take any time or energy or expense, but I'm still not going to do it because I don't feel worthy of it. So I needed to write the book from that perspective. But even for people who are quite skilled in nurturing self, being present and compassionate with self, and I would suggest that we are all pretty good at taking care of other people. You know, most people I know will bend over backwards. They don't want to say no. They want to meet the needs of others. But the missing piece here is allowing ourselves to also receive. And that is so important, not just for our health, but the well-being of our relationships as well.
So everything you've said there is really persuasive, of course. But if someone could hear it and think, okay, that's a nice idea, a nice concept, and I'll try some of the 7 steps that you're going to introduce, maybe at some point. Do you think sometimes it requires something to go wrong due to being selfless for a change to happen?
Do.
And do you have an example of that personally or anyone you've worked with?
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. I can share from my own lived experience. So for me, I became a mum at the same time as my father experiencing motor neurone disease. Now, it was never diagnosed in his lifetime. So he had a breathing failure when I was 40 weeks pregnant with my firstborn. And there was no diagnosis. He survived for 15 months. So you can imagine what life was like in this huge collision of life events. That's where I learned firsthand that this drive to be selfless was actually interfering with my ability to mother as I aspired to, or to be the daughter that I aspired to. I learned really quick smart that my depletion served no one, and actually my replenishment served everyone. And it wasn't just take better care of myself. It was, I had to get really skilled in saying to friends and family, do you know what? I need help. I need support. Please, can you help me in this way? Can you do this? Can you sit with me? Can you help me, you know, getting really granular? So it was that experience of, if I didn't learn the skills of self-advocacy, honestly, I wouldn't be here anymore. Mm. It was literally a matter of survival. But I would hope that people don't have to experience, I mean, the best description I can give there is energetic bankruptcy. The first part of the book is walking everyone through why we've come to associate even turning attention inwards with being something that's shame-inducing. Because so many conversations I have, Adam, and I'd be really curious to hear what you encounter, when people are describing what they're doing when they feel selfish or when they feel guilty, it's not actually, they're not actually selfish actions. Resting is not selfish. Turning down an invitation is not necessarily selfish. Saying no or pushing back on a business deadline is not necessarily selfish. You know, being selfish is where you are only thinking of self to the detriment of others. Mm. What we're talking about here is self-advocacy, where we're becoming skilled in identifying our feelings and needs, and we're voicing those so that we can better pace ourselves, so that we can show up as we aspire to. So two are really different things.
When we think of selfishness, I'd like to get clear on then how we can become more selfish. But before we do that, I'm going to maybe talk about some of the kinds of selfishness I think I encounter in the yoga world and wellness world. Maybe I'll give a few and you can kind of evaluate them a little bit. So one is, I guess, the noble kind of selfishness. You know, the one that says, I won't let anyone down. I won't let my family experience a burnout that I'm going to experience. I'm going to get through it and serve the family, as it were. I guess that's one. So let's say the noble selfishness. Yeah. One might be the productivity one, where I'm going to optimize myself. I'm going to have the perfect wake-up routine, even if that means my partner has to get it with the kids every day. I'm going to do my ice bath, etc. So that's that optimizing self one is one version. Another one I think is very common in the yoga world is a spiritual bypassing kind of selfishness, where you're kind of retreating from all responsibility in life in the name of, let's say, self-healing. And then I guess there's a selfishness in the sense of I'm separate to you and I don't want to move into discomfort. So to avoid discomfort, I'm going to keep a separation up from you. And selfishness is, I don't want to get involved in the world. I want to be selfish and just take care of me as an avoidance strategy almost. So I've thrown a few things at you there. What are your takes on that? Those brands of selfishness.
I would be suggesting we want to move away from that.
Okay.
Yeah. What we want to move towards is just an understanding of, we need to come home to self. Yeah. For most people that I work with, they're so fixated on meeting the needs of others, meeting the deadline, being this perfect version of this. The issue there is, it's just not sustainable. You can't keep all the people happy all the time.
No.
And if your worth is contingent on keeping all the people happy all the time. We are going to reach a state of either we're disappointing others and then we're crippled by the disappointment we feel in ourselves, or we're going to reach a state of burnout. So what I'm talking about here is a sense of balance.
Mm.
And we can only achieve that. And it's never going to be a perfect balance, right? But there has to be reciprocity. That's what I want to move towards. I want to move towards an understanding that we need to take responsibility and engaging healthy, life-giving habits. We want to keep being generous and loving and caring and being connected and present in this world. Yeah, we do need to support others, but we also need to be open and honest with other people about our thoughts, our feelings, our needs, our preferences. And so if we can touch on one of those forms of selfishness, you know, this sense of nobility, I must be self-sufficient. I don't want to let my children in on my struggle. You know, the fact there is you rob them of an opportunity to see you and your humanity.
Mm.
And for children who have grown up in a household where parents have never shared of themselves, they get to adulthood and think, why am I struggling here? Why am I finding this so hard? Because their parent has just seemingly sailed through life unaffected. And that's just, it's not real. We need to share our humanity with our children.
Mm.
And we also need it. I've already mentioned that we need self-advocacy, not just for our health, but for the health of our relationships. The fact is, how can we ever connect meaningfully with any other human being unless we bring our full self to the relationship, not just this mask of perfection or this person who seemingly has no needs or feelings? I mean, that doesn't sound very rewarding, does it? That would be like being in relationship with a robot. Who wants that? Give me the gritty, real, messy humanness so that we've actually got something to play with.
Do you think our desire, we talked about being English, our desire to be selfless, do you think it's conditioning? How did it differ male to female, and how much of it is personality?
Okay, I think we have been marinating in this message since birth that it's not okay to have feelings and it's not okay to have needs.
Mm.
Okay, so let's take a look. Let's chart it. Now, from birth, we know that a good baby is one that doesn't cry. How abhorrent is it that there is even the notion of a bad baby?
Mm-hmm.
It is out and out toxic. But we also know that, okay, yep, we may have moved on from this idea that children should be seen and not heard. But I think still it's loud and clear to our children that a good child is one that doesn't talk back to adults. You must respect and revere your elders and, yeah. The issue there is if we haven't taught our children to advocate for themselves growing up, how the heck are they going to do that in adulthood?
Mm.
And I don't know about you, Adam. I'm nearly 50. I'm a mum of two. I do not see everything. And as a fallible human being, I certainly don't get it right all the time. So when I get it wrong, I want my children to be able to say, do you know what, mum? You haven't quite got that right there. This is what happened, or this is how I feel. But our children are not reared to do that. You look at the nature of the school system, the fact that it systematically distracts and disconnects our children from self because they have to sit still, be quiet, do that thing that they're told to do in this way for this length of time. And don't you dare go to the toilet outside of break time and lunchtime. I mean, I don't know about you, but I certainly haven't trained my bladder to only be, you know, in operation at 10 o'clock in the morning and 1 o'clock. It's just
this
it's
point, at this point in my life, I can just about make it to a yoga class.
Exactly.
But I love this idea of children talking back. I forget what celebrity it was, but they were saying that, you know, when some people come around to their house, they think their kids are rude. And maybe they are a little bit. It's because they question everything. And this is to the extreme, but they talk back,
yep.
They question everything. So, and it's two daughters, actually. Because the view was, this was the dad talking about his daughters. He doesn't want them to get pushed in any way in the future. He wants them to be able to fend for themselves, which I love.
Yeah. Yeah. These are skills that have got to be taught. But then you're absolutely right. You know, there's gender conditioning as well.
Mm.
So I think, I mean, the fact that we've been raised to believe that there are positive and negative emotions from the outset is really unhelpful. The fact is emotions are there as cues to what we need to survive. Yeah. So the fact that, you know, for boys, they're allowed to be angry, but they mustn't be sad. And girls, are welcome to cry, but they mustn't be forthright or outspoken. They've got to be pliant and pleasant, and you know, it's toxic either way. We need to feel our feelings. We need to be taught how to move through our feelings in safe and healthy ways.
What are your thoughts on, this is a slight aside to the topic, but the thoughts on feeling feelings, as it were? Because of course we have emotions there, but they're a natural thing that will occur to us.
Yep.
And then we have a choice to some degree. We can acknowledge them.
Absolutely.
And acknowledge that they come and go and they're transient. And you know, in the yoga world, we could say that we see the person experiencing them, but we are not that person. And we see them and we let them go. We have no attachment to them. Or we could hold on to them and play with them and explore them. And someone could argue, potentially, come back to the idea of selfishness. I'm feeling what I'm feeling. I am sad today. Or I felt the emotion of sad this morning. I'm now going to hold on to that and identify it. And that is me being me, living as I want to live through the day, even though it affects lots of other people. I'm choosing to hold that emotion.
Okay, so I think we've got every right to feel all of our emotions. That doesn't then give us the right to behave however we want with those feelings. Okay, so for women who've been conditioned that you must not be angry, I mean, this is pretty dangerous. From an evolutionary perspective, anger is designed to galvanize you to be able to stand up, to protect those in your care, to protect yourself, but also to stand up in service of your values. So if you're taught that you mustn't be angry, it robs us of this galvanizing energy. That doesn't then give us the right to behave however we wish without anger. Yeah. So I do think it's really useful to that notion of we observe our feelings, but it's also helpful not to identify with our feelings. We feel feelings. I'm not an angry person. I experience anger from time to time. I will experience sadness from time to time. But it's a really useful conversation looking at emotional health, because most people will think that emotional health is feeling happier more often. But actually, that's not true. Emotional health is the ability to identify our feelings and to move through them in safe and healthy ways. And I think this is a bit of a it makes it difficult, because a lot of people come to me saying, I want to feel better. But what they don't realize that in the process of trying to feel better, you're going to feel all of your emotions more acutely. So it's not straightforward, but that is what we need to be healthy individuals. Right? We need to be able to feel our feelings and listen to the cues that are present in those feelings, and sometimes take action, and sometimes we don't need to take action. Sometimes, for example, with joy and pleasure, just savor it, you know? But sometimes if there is disappointment, or if there is frustration, or if there is anger, we need to take a look at where the rub is, and is there some kind of action that's required to recalibrate, or to honor boundaries, or to protect someone else or ourselves.
No, I love this idea that we are there to observe. And it's not about, and I always say that to yoga, isn't about being happy. It's not, you know, happy is a fleeting state like anything else. No, it's about finding an emotional state, whatever it might be, seeing that it's there, but allowing it to path and keep coming back to the middle ground. That is my view, is keep coming back to a more consistent middle where there is, I guess the best way to might be describe it is contentment or equanimity, maybe is a way
equanimity.
To describe it.
Equanimity, I love that word. That's one of my favorite words, Adam.
What does it mean to you in the context of what
equanimity,
you do?
It's like your ability to bear witness without being buffeted so much by it. And I think this is a really important part of the conversation. Another reason why we feel like it's not okay to have feelings and needs is that you look at the emphasis that's placed on resilience. And would you agree that most human beings would feel like, for me to be a good human being, I must be strong, I must be resilient. It's better if I don't have to lean on other people. But the issue is, we've also been taught you can't be selfish. What does resilience take? So, Adam, if you were to sort of have a little scroll through your week, what are the habits that you need to engage in for you to be a resilient, put together, productive human being? What do you do on a regular basis?
So I guess exercise will be one. Exercise will be one.
Yep.
But also I think actually in my personal experience, It could be like Irish Catholic upbringing, you know, yeah. inherent sense of guilt all the time. It could be, I guess, a resilience of just getting on with it and actually maybe putting myself last. So for instance, you know, saying to my wife and family, you have the car. I know that you need to get back. I know our other car's broke. I'm happy to walk 60 minutes to the train station and back again. And I guess sometimes that's how I build resilience, not actively, is I do the uncomfortable thing. Sometimes it's because I want to do it and I enjoy it, yoga, exercise. Right. Sometimes it's, you could argue it's a bit martyr-y. I do the hard thing to save anyone else doing the hard thing as well.
Right. I would argue that it's your other habits that allows you to do that.
Yes,
I would
completely.
Not suggest that you subjugating your needs is the thing that boosts your resilience.
You need you need a formal practice. I say that you you don't
if
do
you
yoga
weren't
off
doing
the mat.
A yoga, if you weren't diligent in your sleep routine, if you weren't nourishing yourself with nutritious food, hydrating yourself, if you didn't have social connection, if you didn't have time in nature, you wouldn't be able to do that part of the resilience. And this is the thing that pisses me off the most. We're taught you must be self-sufficient and productive and resilient. Now, all of those things that you need to be that person, food, hydration, sleep, rest, movement, time in nature, yeah? But you can't be selfish. I'm sorry, we can't have it both ways. If you want me to be resilient, I'm going to need to be able to focus on self. And that's what this book is about. It's about healing our relationship with ourself. You've mentioned guilt. So many people feel crippling guilt that stops them from doing all of these things that would allow us to show up in the world as we aspire to, because we're told we mustn't be selfish.
How much do you think, we'll talk about, I guess, the steps forward for people here.
Mm-hmm.
How much of it in something getting in the way, is it guilt versus, I guess, people letting logistics get in the way? Okay. And
I'd
of course,
more guilt.
The reason I say logistics is not because literally people don't have time, but it's more that people, including myself, will find a very good way to argue that, well, no, yes, it's all well and good saying, you know, do something for myself, but there literally isn't time. And I'm sure if they had a time management consultant, they probably would find time somehow. So like how much of it is pure logistical? How much is guilt? How much is it an overlap or guilt?
I would suggest it is disproportionately guilt. And how do I know that? I've written 10 of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All of these books have practices that you could do in 30 seconds, 60 seconds. You can do them at the same time as other things. It's a breathing practice. You can do it while you're on your commute. You could do it while you're making dinner. But people are still not doing it, not because they haven't got the time, but because fundamentally they feel uncomfortable with their personhood. They feel uncomfortable with allowing themselves their basic humanity, because we've been reared to say, push through, get on with it, don't focus on self. Feelings and needs, superfluous, too much. What's wrong with you? Yeah, it's guilt.
Do you work with clients that over time they've come to you, they've identified that actually, yeah, over the last few years I've abandoned myself, or they've actively been the villain in their own little self-care story?
I would suggest that most of the people coming to me will say, I want to be a better parent. I want to be a better partner. I want to be more effective in my business. I want to be a better daughter. Is this constant striving? They feel like they're failing. What they don't realize is that they're failing at something that is humanly impossible to deliver. And the reason why is because what we've been asked to do is just, it's too much for any human being. Yeah, we've been raised to believe that you can't rest until you've cleared your to-do list. You can't take care of your needs until you've met the needs of everyone else. Yeah, that would be like saying to your car, once you've got me there, then I'll fill up the tank.
Mm-hmm.
It's an absolute nonsense.
So what are the seven steps that people can start to work towards? Is it physical first? Is it in their head first?
Interesting. Okay. So with this seven steps, there is a scaffolding What we're doing is we're building skills and we're removing barriers along the way. So step one is I reclaim my mind. So this is all about looking at these self-limiting beliefs that are the obstacles to us nourishing ourselves or receiving support. So the first part of the book is taking a look at all of these cultural underpinnings and how we've been conditioned. We've got to hold these up to the light to see them for the untruths that they are. So some of these beliefs are, I can't be selfish, I must be selfless, I can't allow anyone else to support me, I can't focus on self. Okay, we've got to hold these up to the light, because until we unpick these things, I could give everyone a gazillion practices, but no one's going to do them because we don't feel it's okay to do them. And part of step one is also understanding that there is a fundamental difference between thoughts and self-talk. Your thoughts, that's the first thing that comes to you, right? And if it just comes to you, you don't choose it. You don't have control over it. So there's no point trying to change that thing because it's outside of your control. But what you do have influence over is how you respond to that thought, your self-talk. And step one, getting your mind on side, is making peace with difficult, unpleasant thoughts, but at the same time, getting your self-talk on side, because that is fundamental to us healing our relationship with self. Mm. We need to learn how to speak to ourselves with dignity and respect.
How do you do that?
No more trash talk. Mm. Trash talk is a form of self-harm. Okay?
I quote this a lot in the yoga class. It's from the Idols, who are a punk band. Like, if someone spoke to you the way you spoke to you, I'd punch them in the face. Love yourself.
Yes.
It's a punk band, but there's a lot of meaning there.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. But the fact is, your brain's still going to generate stuff. And this is the thing I want people to know. I'm a psychologist with 30 years practice. I still have catastrophic thoughts. I still have really toxic thoughts. I still have really unhelpful thoughts. This is just what the brain does. It's not about eradicating that. It's about saying, oh, there's that thing. That's just come to me. That's not who I am. I don't need to invest my identity in that. I don't have to invest my beliefs in that. I get to choose what I do with that. But this is where the self-talk is so important, that we use coaxing, encouraging words. And for anyone that finds that difficult, I have a little practice. Should we do a little practice?
Oh, go on then.
Adam, are you up for it?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. So can we rub hands together to create warmth?
I'm trying. I've got a mic in my hand, but I'm
you got a microphone.
But I'm also quite warm anyway, so we're good.
Okay. So let's do one hand. Just put one hand on your heart. Yeah, this is a somatic hold. What I find is it's really hard to generate punitive, judgmental, critical self-talk when I'm doing this gesture.
Hmm.
Hang on. I can be tender with myself. I can do that. And for anyone that's saying, do you know what? I could do this till the cows come home and I've still got this negative stuff going on. I would say, this is backed by research. If we speak to ourselves using you or I, you can imagine the kind of self-talk that generates. You dick, you idiot, you this, you that, right? When we speak to ourselves using a term of endearment, research shows that calling yourself something like sweetie, honey, mine is bunny, we create kinder, more encouraging self-talk, because who can trash talk bunny? She doesn't deserve that. So that's the first homework I would love everyone to come away with from this episode with. What's your pet name going to be? What's yours, Adam? What do you use?
I like concept. I wonder how well that works for men. Like, men can go the whole way the other way. There's a guy called David Goggins who's an elite runner. You might have come across him or not, but obscene person. Like, he will run 500 miles. Ex-Navy SEAL. He is core, like, inspirational person. Everyone, like, people in gyms have quotes of him on the wall. He is insane. And in his book, which was a bestseller, he talked about when he was larger, he would look in a mirror and just basically abuse himself. And it helped, because it turned him into this fit athletic guy. And then, you know, 5 years later, he was a Navy SEAL. And that whole arc is basically be harsh to yourself and that's how you grow. And I guess, I'm not a fan of that, of course. But I wonder how well that lands for men, and what other strategies there might be. Like, I've used a strategy Because I don't call myself, I've got no pet name for myself. And I think that's because perhaps I have no pet name for my friends or even my wife. There's no pet names involved. And I found what's quite useful, and maybe this isn't a valid tactic, is to really step back and like write a letter or something as if it's to a friend in my situation. Because I'm going to be always kinder to a friend and then read it back.
This is the thing. Different things will motivate different people. But I would suggest for anyone who is constantly trash-talking themselves, it wouldn't be a surprise if your nervous system was in a constant state of the stress response.
No, I bet. I bet.
Yeah? It's, you know, I would not advocate for that. And actually research
He's not a happy man. Nothing about him suggests he's happy and content in life. And most people that do that kind of thing, with one exception, they're running away from something, I find. The people that run 500 miles, or when I used to run ultras, I was running away from stuff. Yep. There's one guy called Ross Edgley, who recently swam around Iceland, previously swam around the UK, the whole UK, who I think must just be insane, because he's just the happiest, jolly person in the world, very well-spoken, from Bath, I think. But beyond him, everyone else I've experienced in the inspirational world, especially for men, their nervous system, as you say, is probably shot to shit.
Well, do you know what I think? I don't speak to my son any differently than I speak to my daughter.
Mm.
And I want my son to have access to a comforting part of himself that he has embodied by learning what it feels like to be comforted and cared for by me.
Lovely.
So I call him, he's my little honey bear. And I want him to know that he is deeply deserving of tenderness, just as much as my daughter is.
Mm.
But it's, you know, it doesn't have to be a pet name. If that strikes a chord, we work with that, or we use a somatic hold because that will help us cultivate kinder self-talk. Research actually shows that self-forgiveness helps us delay gratification and take action in service of our values far better than punitive words. So this whole notion, I think we've been raised to believe that get tough on yourself and that will garner better performance. Research doesn't bear that out.
No. It might I imagine it might create more objective success that can be viewed externally, i.e. more money in the bank, but not actually happiness.
Or a faster marathon time.
Yeah, no, indeed.
Yeah, I'm interested in peace. I'm interested in living with a sense of ease. I'm interested in helping people come home to self so that they can feel safe to be honest and open with other people so that we can actually come together and support each other and actually share our humanity. That's what I'm interested in.
Do you think, this is an extreme example, so you talked about kind of fastest marathon time. I myself at a point in my life with obsessive marathons and looking good and low body fat and alike, do you feel that, you know, there's an increasing rise in these kind of activities? You know, every other person doing a marathon now, high rocks, etc. Do you see any overlap between people doing these kind of activities, you know, being very obsessed with them and it becomes very much their life, to the degree that it could become, you know, they could say, well, it's my self-care, but then actually it almost is a form of escapism and then almost a self, you could also argue then it is too selfless.
Or it's a form of atonement.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
You know, for some people it's punishment. You know, and I would suggest that any of these practices that are designed to help you fit this ideal of well, your body's meant to look like this, or this is what a good man or a good woman looks like. You know, I would question whether that's actually self-advocacy. This is just whipping ourselves into shape for this ever-moving ideal.
Which is, I guess you could say it's selfless towards society. Society needs more people that look like this. Or maybe even selflessness towards a future partner that wants you to look a certain way.
I think it needs to, at its heart, it's got to be nourishing. At its heart, it's got to be with our health and our well-being as the driving force, not because we're trying to prove our worth.
I love that word.
Or make up for some, you know, perceived lack.
I love the word nourish in that context. And maybe that's something we should all do, like step back and ask ourselves, are the activities that we're doing, even ones that are labeled as self-care, are yes. they actually nourishing us? Because I'm sure you've
is
encountered...
Is this nourishing? Is it nurturing? And is it not only like nurturing in this moment, is it actually nurturing my future self?
Mm.
Yeah, because I've got to a point now at 48, I've got arthritis in my toes and I've got arthritis in my knee. And I had to make a really painful decision to give up running. Now, running for me, I love it. Ugh. You know, it helped me feel alive. But I had to be really honest with myself. If I keep doing that, is my 80-year-old body going to be grateful for that form of movement? And I had to have a word with myself. It wasn't.
And what, I had, there's what's a grieving. Replaced it for you?
I've gone back to my yoga.
Nice. Welcome back to the side.
Yeah, thank you.
Now we talked.
The reason why I moved away from it because there were some things that weren't accessible to me anymore.
Mm.
And being on my yoga mat, I was faced with this. You know, I don't compare myself to other human beings anymore. This is my incarnation. I don't have to look like that supermodel. I'm good with that. But what I was still doing was comparing me in this moment to who I was 20 years ago. And there was a real grief. There was a loss. I can't do a broken toe pose anymore because my big toe just doesn't have that flexibility. So for a long while there, like you said, sometimes our self-care is a form of escapism because I didn't want to be faced with this new limitation because it was really painful. So there has been a real grappling with, I've got to come to a place of acceptance that this is where I'm at right now. And how can I meet myself with far greater tenderness and lovingly tend in a way that supports me now and supports the person that I'm becoming.
Nice. We'll move on to some quick farby ones now.
Okay.
So we've talked about the mind in a sense, and yes. know, there was some physical stuff there as well. Is yep. there any other physical tips you might give someone or even Absolutely. Just one activity they could do to connect?
Yes. Can we just have a quick look at the 7 steps? So we've got
yeah,
that.
Let's go through them. Let's go through the context.
And then
yeah.
there's one practice that kind of brings it all together.
Oh, sounds good.
Okay. So step one is I reclaim my mind. Step two is I reclaim my senses. So this is about just noticing where our attention goes because we are distracted left, right, and center, aren't we? So step two is coming home to your senses, which is a segue. Step three, which is coming home to the body. Can't come home to the body until you come home to the senses. So you can see there's this scaffolding. When we come home to the body, this is all about how we can soothe our nervous system so that we can feel safe and confident to be able to know ourselves, but also speak up. So mind, senses, body. Step four is I reclaim my right to feel. So this is what we were talking about before, allowing ourselves to feel all of our feelings. Step five, I take back my moral compass. So we've examined everything that we've been told a good human being looks like. Step five is you get to choose what that is for yourself. And then step six, we learn how to prioritize self. Now, this is all about our promises to self, our boundaries with self. And step seven, now that you've done all of that stuff, you've nourished yourself, you're well-resourced. Step seven is how the heck do we get brave enough to have these conversations with other people so that they can understand who we are, what our needs are, and they can reciprocate and take care of us too. So that is the roadmap of how we can build the skills of self-advocacy. Now, a practice that brings all of that together. I'm curious, Adam, do you have a glass of water with you?
I have an energy drink. Does that count?
Great. Yeah, that counts. Yes.
On that note, excellent. These seven okay. steps, how long might those 7 steps take to progress through?
It might take your entire lifetime, and that is fine, right?
Does it have to be in order? Like, do you feel like you have to need to finish step three to get to step four? Because it could take a lifetime.
No.
Is that what I mean? Yeah.
No, but I would suggest it's very hard to advocate for yourself with other people if you've not learned to honor boundaries with yourself.
Indeed.
And it's very hard to have an idea of what your boundaries are until you've connected with self, because you need to understand what your feelings and needs are to be able to inform, you know, what you need to feel safe and healthy with other people. So there's a scaffolding of skills.
Nice.
And if you want to learn how to regulate your nervous system, you're going to have to be connected with your senses. And it's going to be difficult to connect with your senses if you're constantly telling yourself, I mustn't focus on self, right? So there is this kind of laddering, scaffolding. But it's, you know, it's okay.
A laddering of understanding, but you don't need perfection yes. in one before you get to the next.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
You can,
I've got my I've got my peach vibe.
I'm hoping that everyone has access to a little hydration. What I would encourage everyone to do is, can we tenderly place a hand on heart and then take a little sip? So Adam, that's going to be hard for you, but everyone else at home can try this. Hands on heart and then take a little sip. Now, when we place a hand on the heart, it changes the sensory experience of drinking. It awakens our senses to notice the temperature of what it is that you're drinking, the flavor of it, how it feels in your mouth, how it feels as you swallow it. And it also, you can really connect with the rejuvenating properties of it, as opposed to just, you know, knock it back and you haven't even noticed. So this is a really simple practice. We'll awaken our senses to come home to self, come home to the body, but the practice isn't done yet. There are two prompts that I would love everyone to pair with this very everyday ritual. After you've done hand on heart and had a couple of sips, I want you to say to yourself, where am I at? What's happening? What is going on right now? Where's my body at? What kind of emotional tones are circulating? Where's my head at? And based on those observations, what do I need? And then go and do it. Now, it could be something as simple as, I haven't got up and out of my chair for half an hour. I just need to stretch my legs, or I need some fresh air. Or actually, do you know what? I've been putting off going to the loo. I need to do that. Or I need a hug. Or where's the cat? Can I sit with the cat in my lap for a minute? Yeah, can you see how this little purposeful pause brings us home to self and just allows us to let ourself feature in our day a little more prominently?
Oh, that's lovely. What a nice way to end it. But maybe just one further question. If you could advise listeners to kind of do one selfish act for themselves this coming week, you know, maybe little, but kind of maybe some sense brave as well, what might that be?
Ooh, okay. The funny thing is, I don't want to be bossy. I don't want to be dictatorial, because I want to flip it round. I want to flip it round and just, I would invite people to say, if I was selfish, I would. Like, what would that be? Would it be prioritizing an early night?
Mm-hmm.
Would it be finally getting brave and saying to a friend, if there's been something that's bugging you for months, would it be finally just, how can you gently let that friend know, right? These things that we stop ourselves from doing, it could be something as simple as just actually lying down and doing that yoga nidra that you've been thinking about for the last 6 months. Yeah. What speaks to you? Because the thing about self-advocacy is it's meeting your needs. So my needs might be totally different from yours, Adam, but also my needs this afternoon will be totally different from what they are tomorrow morning. So I would just, if people need a salient practice, it would be, can we cradle our chin in our hands? And can we just say, do you know what? I'm here. What do I need? How can I be here for myself? Or how can I get brave and speak up so that some other human being can also meet my needs? Because we're designed to be a social animal. Like we're never, ever going to be able to meet everyone else's needs. And also we can't, it's not about shouldering our burden alone. Sometimes we need the love and support of others. So making space for that.
You know, I love what you said there about the kind of negative questioning. Like what would being selfish look like right now? And you know, you can use it for this purpose, but I've used it for business planning as well. Like yes. If I wanted to fail, what would I do? And do the opposite. That kind of thing. I love it. I really love it. So your book is out this weekend.
It's coming out Thursday week.
And pre-order is available now, I'm sure, on Amazon and alike.
Yep. Available for pre-order. Absolutely.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining again. And of course, you can all listen to the previous episode that was recorded a few years ago as well, where we talked about, yes, I forget which book it was at the time, but was it a festive book? It could have been a festive book.
It wasn't Self-Care for Winter, was it? I can't remember.
Maybe it was. So perfect.
Might have been Self-Care.
Both books. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure, Adam. Thank you so much for sparking these much needed but let's be honest, these are difficult conversations. So thank you for going there. Honestly, unbalanced.